I'm Mitt Romney, and I approve of this podcast.
Welcome to the CES Podcast, where PhD Bible scholar Dr. Sheldon Greaves discusses this year's seminary and institute curriculum with Michael Barker, a man who has a 14-year-old daughter in seminary but has zero training in biblical scholarship and so has no business even discussing the Bible, but is going to give his opinions anyways regarding this year's curriculum, which covers the New Testament.
Welcome to episode 5 of the CES podcast for the rest of us. I'm here again with Dr. Sheldon Greaves.
Say hello, Sheldon.
Hey, hello. How you doing, Mike?
I'm doing great. And good. Today we are going to be discussing Matthew chapters 23 all the way to the end, which is Matthew, I think it was 28. So this is a lot. We're going to get we're going to get some parables. We're going to get Jesus, getting taken in by the high priest. We're going to get Pontius Pilate. We're going to get Jesus and then the passion narrative. We get the Passover in there. We get him being crucified, and we have Jesus being resurrected. So there's a freaking lot of stuff cram into a half hour.
It's a busy week, for him. A lot going on. And, good heavens, where do you want to start? I mean, there's, I suppose 23 is a good place to start, because this is probably, at least for Matthew, where he rips on the Pharisees. I mean, he really lets them have it. It's kind of amazing, because one of the things he does here, he's talking about, them getting all hung up about stupid things like the tithes on herbs and stuff like that. And apparently Jesus has a very low tolerance for that kind of nitpicking nonsense. And so much so that this is one of the few times that we actually see Jesus invoking hellfire against somebody. He doesn't usually go there, but he is just really pissed off at these guys for worrying about what for him are just trivialities. And when there are so much more important, so much more urgent things going on.
Yeah.
It pretty much speaks for itself. You don't need a whole lot of interpretation. One thing too here, though, there's a couple of things that might need some a little explanation. For example, this thing in verse 24, when he says, "You blind guides who strain out a gnat but swallow a camel." If an animal died because of drowning, it was unclean. Insects were unclean anyway, except for locusts. But here, you're straining the gnats out of your drink to keep from, from ingesting an unclean bug that you might not even notice otherwise. But then you turn around and swallow a camel, which is unclean. Camels are for an animal to be clean, it had to have hoofs and chew its cud. Well, camels chew their cud, but they don't have hoofs. And pigs, by contrast, they have hoofs, but they don't chew their cud. So
okay, yeah. When it says strain the gnat, I thought they meant like trying really hard to look at it.
Yeah.
So it made no freaking sense to me. Like, all right.
Yeah, it's like you're straining it out of your water or your wine or whatever. Or in his So the other thing here is when he's comparing them to whitewashed tombs, which I think is kind of funny. The reason the tombs were whitewashed was because they were tombs. They were full of dead people, and so they were a source of corpse contamination, which would make you ritually impure. So you whitewash the tombs as a warning, stay away from here.
Oh, it makes it stand out.
Yeah, it makes it stand out, so people will stay away from the tombs and therefore avoid, you know, getting ritually contaminated. And he's basically saying, you know, he's comparing them to a source of ritual contamination, which is like one of the worst. You know, corpse contamination is particularly bad because it's one of the few forms of contamination that can be transferred to another person by touch.
Oh, so you can get the cooties.
Right, exactly. And you know, it's a great comparison because, you know, when he's talking about the Pharisees teaching the other people, I mean, it's not hard to draw the comparison that what they're spreading among the people is a contagion rather than any kind of, you know, holiness or proper, you know, religious sense. So it's, you know, it's a real zinger.
Oh, my gosh. You know, yeah, that really hits home.
Yeah, and then, of course, he goes from there. And speaking of tombs, you know, tombs of the prophets, you know, which you decorate and everything, and you say, if they had lived in our day, we wouldn't have done that. And he says, oh, yes, you would. And which is, I guess, another way of saying, you know, in fact, you're doing it now. So now here's another thing, too, is that in 34, he says, therefore, I send you prophets, sages, and scribes.
Yeah.
And this is one of the first places, I think, where Jesus is talking as if he were God.
That jumped out to me, too. In my notes, I actually had a kind of a question about that.
Yeah. Yes.
Where he gets pretty bold here in the Matthean account.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he does. And I don't really know that there's that much more to say about it, except, wow, look at that. You know, look what he's doing there. So, yeah, and of course, you mentioned in our correspondence that wonderful feminine image of God gathering, you know, the brood under her wings.
Yeah.
But they didn't want to do it. They were unwilling. So, you know, it's a very poignant statement, but it's also kind of fun to think that Jesus is willing to use a female metaphor to describe God.
Yeah, and for us Mormons, especially those that kind of are seeking out the divine feminine that we call Mother in Heaven, that can kind of speak to that as well, as kind of, you know, Jesus giving a nod to a heavenly mother, or the divine feminine, or however you want to to call her. May I ask you, before we move to 24, may I ask you two, I think they'll be quick questions.
Yeah.
35, Zechariah, son of Berechiah. Who the frick is that?
Yeah.
Do you have any historical thing about him?
Basically, we got nothing on him. However, if they murdered him between the sanctuary and the altar, that means he was murdered in the temple.
Yeah, sounds not good, right?
Not good, which, you know, I mean, speaking of corpse contamination, you know, that is like seriously nasty for someone to get killed in the temple like that. You know, I mean, there used to be a tradition, the altar would have these projections on the corners, these horns, and apparently the altar was a place of refuge at one point, where you could go to the altar and grasp the horns of the altar, and you were immune from being killed by somebody who might be after you, like, you know, to avenge a, you know, to do like blood vengeance or something like that. I don't remember the exact details of it, but, you know, I mean, there are several reasons why the temple is called the sanctuary, and one of them is that you shouldn't expect to get murdered in there.
Yeah, sounds reasonable.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
You had another question?
Yeah, a little bit earlier, verse 23, you know, lists justice, mercy, and crap, I lost it now. Jesus gives
mercy and faith. All right.
So yeah, verse 23, justice, mercy, faith. So my question is this, and within Mormonism, you know, when justice and mercy are put together, it's usually like mercy cannot rob justice, and justice seems to mean like punishment for things you've done wrong and blessings mm-hmm. for things you've done right. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering, from what Greek word is justice translated in this instance, and does it carry a different meaning?
Well, I didn't have a chance to look up the Greek word, but I will. Okay. But what we are probably talking about is the Jewish idea of justice, which is neither of those things.
Okay.
The Jewish view of justice isn't about retribution or reward. It's about setting the world right. So if you see someone who is in need of food and you give them food, that's an act of justice because it puts the world back the way it's supposed to be.
Oh, okay. That's very beautiful.
It's a really wonderful thing. And in fact, the Jewish word for justice is also the same word that you use for charity.
Oh.
So it makes perfect sense to see justice and mercy put together in the same sentence here.
For sure.
They're complementary. They're not in opposition to each other.
Yeah. Oh, that's fascinating. Okay. Yeah. All right. Yeah, that's good. Mm-hmm. All right. Where do you want to take us now?
Let's go to 24. All right. This is kind of a little mini apocalypse here, you know, where he's talking about the temple and what's going to happen to it. And, oh my gosh. I mean, there's a general consensus that this was probably written after, the destruction of the temple, which kind of makes sense. I mean, you know, this is fairly common to see post facto prophecy.
Yeah, it seems to come out of no. It doesn't fit into what's going on. Also, it seems very out of place.
It does. It does.
I'll say, yeah.
Yeah, and I think that's probably a result of this being kind of shoehorned in there. Now, just quickly, I suppose we could talk about where he's saying to the disciples, you know, hey, guess what? You know, they're going to be people coming along who are claiming to be the Messiah, and they're going to lead a lot of people away after them. And, mm-hmm. you know, the disciples are generally described as dim bulbs, you know, but I think in this case, they were probably looking at each other, rolling their eyes and saying, yeah, tell us something we don't know, you know, because we have all these records of all these, revolts and rebellions and whatnot. I mean, Josephus lists a number of them. There was a guy named Simon of Perea, who was a former slave of Herod the Great, and he led a rebellion. And when Herod died, there were several other rebellions, and they were all crushed. But it took about 2 years for the Romans to do it. There was a guy named Hezekiah, the brigand chief, who was executed by Herod. And he had a son, Judas of Sepphoris, who also led a revolt against the Romans. There was some guy called the Egyptian prophet who tried to reenact the crossing, reenact the Exodus at the shores of the Jordan with 30,000 followers, and they were massacred by the Roman procurator Antonius Felix.
Holy crap.
Yeah, there was also this guy, John of Giscala, who was a fanatic anti-Roman, and he considered anyone who wanted to make peace with the Romans to be a traitor and a sympathizer. And this was just before the Jewish War broke out. He seized power in Jerusalem, he entered the temple, he murdered the high priest and 8,500 other people that he considered to be Roman sympathizers, all in one day.
Oh.
So that gives you some idea of, you know, what was going on. I mean, you could hardly turn around without running into somebody, you know, who was either pretending to be following or had heard recently about some new messianic movement.
And interesting.
It's also why the Romans tended to be pretty ruthless with these things. I mean, their standard procedure was to kill the leader and then find as many of the followers as they could and kill them. They didn't do that with Jesus, which is kind of an interesting thing, and probably and one of the big reasons why Christianity survived. But
that's an interesting point.
Long story short, the Christian movement was nonviolent. Jesus preached nonviolence, so you know, he says, my kingdom is not of this world, and since his followers weren't trying to necessarily overthrow the Roman government by force of arms, they kind of figured, okay, well, you know, we can let this one slide.
Yeah.
Besides, where are they? We can't pull them out of the population anyway. They're not running around, you know, raving and waving knives, you know. So we don't know who they are. So
that's interesting, because your perspective that you bring up is a little bit different than Dr. Aslan, who wrote, you know, that 2 years ago wrote the book about Jesus. His view was that the Christians were violent, and that they were worried of being oppressed, and so the scripture that they end up writing down is to kind of tell the Romans, don't worry about us, we actually aren't violent.
Yeah.
And I remember in your review, you kind of talked about that.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And, you know, Aslan, I do disagree with him on that point, but his book is really, really good. If you want to learn about messianic movements and messianism at that time, it's really good. He brings it all together.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. And it's a good read. It's an easy read.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah, he writes well. He's very easy to read.
So I have a question. As I was studying this, in verse 3, you know, talks about the Mount of Olives.
Yes.
And so as I was reading this, I read this piece. It said the Mount of Olives was the place, according to tradition, the temple departing glory of God. And then they had me look at Ezekiel 10:10, Ezekiel 11:23, 27:40. And so, like, for example, Ezekiel 11:23 says, the Spirit lifted me up and brought me in vision by the Spirit of God into Chaldea to the exiles. So I'm like, what the crap is the parting glory of God? I've never heard this before.
Yeah, you know, I got to tell you, I haven't heard that phrase either.
Okay.
But, you know, Ezekiel is kind of like Isaiah on acid, you know.
Yeah.
It's a little strange. And the Mount of Olives, you know, if I remember too, I think this is associated with ascensions into heaven and various things like that. So,
all right.
I'm going to kind of have to punt on that one.
Yeah, no problem.
Yeah. But if it's all right, all the same to you, I'm thinking, why don't we bash on to 25?
Let's do it.
Because we've got a whole lot of parables going on here.
Yeah, there's like three, I think.
And they all talk about, most of them talk about not being caught flat-footed when the important moment arrives, you know.
Yeah. Now, the scholars use a word parousia. Is that how you say it?
Parousia.
Parousia.
Yeah.
And it has to do with – does that have to do specifically with the second coming or just the coming of God in general? How is that word usually used?
Well, it's come to mean the second coming.
Okay.
But its original meaning was to be used like of a parade or something like that, you know, some kind of very auspicious entrance.
Something you would see for sure.
Yeah, you couldn't miss it.
Okay.
And you know, mainstream Christianity, when they talk about the parousia, they're talking about the second coming.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Sure. Let's see. So we have the now all of these are highly metaphorical, you know, because a bridesmaid doesn't have oil for their lamps, you don't send them to hell. I mean, that's kind of your way of seeing that there is a spiritual aspect to this, because where do you end up afterwards is important. Mm-hmm. And you also have the same thing going on with the talents, you know, but in both cases, the person who doesn't do what they're supposed to do ends up, you know, in hell with teeth gnashing and all that sort of thing. But he's saying, you know, be ready, because this is, the destruction of the temple was for obvious reasons, was believed to be, the signal that the last days were happening.
Oh.
I mean, think about it, you know. We talk about, you know, Jerusalem was going to be under siege and you know, there are all these things that are going to happen. Well, all those things did happen. you know, in 68-70 CE, and they were happening with a vengeance, and, you know, you could see the smoke and smell the blood. I mean, it was about as apocalyptic as it gets. So for them to think that the world was about to end right then and there, yeah, of course they did.
Yeah. You can kind of see that mirrored in early Mormonism, mm-hmm. where a lot of people felt the same thing with there's a thought that the reason Wilford Woodruff was willing to – I mean, Mormons didn't really give up polygamy with the manifesto, but one of the ideas is that Wilford Woodruff was willing to give that up because Jesus was going to come anyways, because look what the heck is going on. You know, we're out in the middle of nowhere. We're being persecuted.
Yeah.
You know, things like that.
Yeah. Exactly. And that's kind of the funny thing. Well, I don't know if funny is the right word. The interesting thing about apocalyptic literature is that it seems to resonate with so many different people, because we all kind of face our, you know, each generation has its own apocalypse, you know, has mm-hmm. its own what looks like a world-ending threat.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always going to speak to people who are facing that kind of a challenge. But now, starting in 31, this is something I find to be incredibly important, because this is where you get the thing about, all nations will be gathered, and he will separate one people from another as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats, and he will put the sheep at his right hand and the goats at the left. And this is where they say, you know, well, okay, you know, who's a sheep and who's a goat? Well, the sheep are the ones, I was hungry and you gave me food, I was thirsty and you gave me something to drink, I was a stranger and you welcomed me, I was naked and you clothed me, I was sick and you took care of me, I was in prison and you visited me. Those are the things that matter. And those are the things that he's just totally pissed off at the Pharisees a few chapters ago for ignoring. You know, this is the criteria that's going to decide where you end up.
Yeah, it's really interesting, because the ones before that kind of have to, like you said, it's all about being prepared so you're not flat-footed. But then Jesus is like, all of a sudden, he's talking about taking care of the marginalized. It's so beautiful the way the King James Version reads it. There's a rhythm to it.
Yeah.
Too, which makes it very, very poetic, I think. And of course, you know, the Barkers, we're big fans of the music group Cake, and they have a song called Sheep Go to Heaven, Goats Go to Hell, which just cracks us up, and it's a fun song too.
Yeah.
Go to heaven, goats go to hell. Go to hell.
But it's a catchy tune. But yeah, it's really interesting that Jesus kind of ends his parables with that, you know, that one.
Yeah, and here it is, it's 26. Okay, 2 days, Passover's coming, and I'm going to be crucified.
Yeah.
You know, and that's kind of like, whoa, dude, you know, serious buzzkill here, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
But we've got some interesting stuff happening here.
Can you tell us a little bit about Caiaphas?
Yeah.
What does it mean to be a high priest? How does he get power? Is he a descendant of the Hasmoneans? Yeah.
I don't know if he was a descendant of the Hasmoneans or not. I do know that, like most other high priests at that time, he was appointed by a Roman governor. And he and the governor apparently had a very good working relationship. I mean, Caiaphas was one of the longest serving high priests in the history of Palestine. And not only that, he had, I think, 5 sons and a son-in-law, all of whom, I believe, became high priest in their turn.
Okay.
So he was, you know, quite the dynasty and very important. Now, Caiaphas as the high priest, when the Persians sent the Jews back out of exile, you know, they said, okay, you can set up your temple again and you can set up a high priest, but they were forbidden from having a king. You know, Cyrus was the king, you know, the Persian was the king, so you couldn't have a king, but you could have a high priest. But the high priest kind of started acquiring the trappings of a king and eventually the power of a king. Even though they didn't call him that, they just called him a, you know, a high priest because they preferred to have a theocracy. So the high priest was basically the most powerful person, at least in Jewish politics. Now, you know, the Romans came in, of course, they can't claim to have, you know, supreme power anymore, but, they do have certain rights. For example, the Sanhedrin is this council of 70 elders, and the 71st is the high priest, who's kind of the head of the Sanhedrin. They're a lawmaking body. They're a court. It's kind of interesting that I believe it's is it here in Matthew that Jesus is taken before the Sanhedrin? I think it is. Because the Sanhedrin was the only court that could try the king if there was a king.
Oh.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And so, you know, I think there's a certain kind of – I mean, if there isn't literary irony going on right there, I don't know that I can't recognize it.
Yeah. That is interesting. So tell me, the Sanhedrin were made up of what exactly now?
Yeah.
Were they're mostly Sadducees, I would assume, and not Pharisees, right?
That's right. They were connected with the temple priesthood, and they were responsible for, you know, enforcing Jewish law and, you know, taking the high-profile cases. Now, there were lesser Sanhedrins that consisted of 23 people, 23 men, and those were out in some of the outlying areas. You could have like a town here or a town there that had its own Sanhedrin, you know, and those were called the lesser court, you know, whereas the Sanhedrin was the greater court. And that was basically a legal body, but it also would take up other kinds of political things. And they met pretty much every day, except on festivals and on the Sabbath.
Okay.
So they were probably about as close as it got to any kind of parliament, maybe.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm just reviewing Matthew 26. It calls them a council of high priests, but it doesn't ever explicitly call them the Sanhedrin. So that must come from one of the other Gospels where they
– I think it does, yeah. I think John refers to them as the Sanhedrin. I don't recall the others. But
okay.
Now, you made a point too that as we look at the account of, you know, the Jesus' passion, as you get later and later chronologically, they get more and more anti-Semitic. Or anti-Jewish might be more precise, but that's absolutely right, because as time went on, you know, Christianity and Judaism start splitting apart. They start going their separate ways, and in the early years, you know, the early days of Paul and the early Acts of the Apostles, they're not even called Christians. You know, in the book of Acts, they're simply called the people of the way, whatever that means.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until sometime later that that the name Christian got applied to them.
Okay.
So
I remember. I first came across that idea of one way to kind of date which gospel comes before the other is how anti-Jewish it is, and I think I learned that from Bart Ehrman.
Yeah.
And also, you know, we mentioned this earlier in Acts, we see the apostles going to the temple. We see Paul specifically as kind of an act of contrition regarding the council in Jerusalem going to the temple as well. So, yeah, kind of the idea that most people just saw the Christians as a Jewish sect and they don't really break off, you know, till till later.
That's right. That's right. I mean, we have records of Christians meeting in synagogues and teaching in synagogues and using synagogues for their meetings and what have you. I mean, it really was just another form of Judaism. And we also have some Roman documents, some letters, from people saying, well, look, you told me to do something about these Christians, but I can't tell the Christians from the Jews.
Oh.
How am I supposed to do that? How am I supposed to know which is which? And it's not clear to me that they're making all that much trouble anyway, so what's the big deal?
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, it is very interesting. But that also, takes us, and I don't know if that takes us out of 26 yet. I think we're still in 26. When Jesus is arrested and he's mm-hmm. brought before the council, they're not able to do anything with him. I mean, they can't come up with any kind of a conviction. He refuses to defend himself. He refuses to... And they're looking for witnesses and testimony that mm-hmm. they could put him to death, but they can't do it. Now, the Sanhedrin did have the power to issue capital punishment for blasphemy. That would have been stoning to death.
Yeah.
But they really didn't have much.
No, as I was kind of looking, I was trying to pay close attention to what their accusations were, and the mm-hmm. accusations were, one, that Jesus would destroy the temple and build it up again, mm-hmm. which is interesting because the temple was built by a non-Jew, Herod. I find it kind of a little ironic, mm-hmm. but and then the other one is that he said he was the Messiah and he was the Son of God. And to be honest, at least in the Matthean account, I looked back and Jesus never explicitly calls himself the Messiah, and he never explicitly calls himself the Son of God either.
That's right.
So other people might have made the connection. Now, the one thing maybe you can tell me about this, I decided to look up about this title, the Son of God, and it seems to have some connection to Davidic kingship.
Mm-hmm. That's right. That's right. There was a tradition in Israelite royalty that the king, when he ascended the throne, he was adopted basically by God as his son. And one of the things that we have left over from that is in Psalm 2.
This makes sense now.
Okay, now we're God says it's what's known as an ascension psalm, as yes. ascending to the throne for a coronation. And God says, thou art my son. Today I have begotten you, or I've yes. adopted you. Which, yes. interestingly enough, is the same scripture that's quoted when Jesus gets baptized.
Yes. Yes.
And there is a school of thought. There's a Christian theological position that holds that Jesus didn't really become the Son of God until he was baptized.
Mm-hmm.
And the voice from heaven making that declaration is when he was fully realized as the Son of God. Up to that point, he was just an ordinary person like anyone else, but then that's when he became truly divine.
Interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a majority opinion, but it's out there, and it's kind of interesting because it tries to make sense of that whole ascension psalm thing.
Okay, all right, yeah.
This podcast is way better than freaking Hamilton.